I'm going to call this meeting officially to order. And Representative Ward, I'll move House File 2317 to be before the committee, and it's to be re-referred to the Environment Natural Resources Policy Committee. And Representative Ward, you want to describe your bill?
Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you very much. And members, thank you for having us here today. I have with me two testifiers, Patrick Russo from the City Administrator of Brainerd, and then Todd Wicklund with the Brainerd Public Utilities. And members, this is we won't take a lot of time because this is a pretty straightforward bill. This is about the Brainerd Dam that was previously owned by Wausau Paper, who has now closed. Prior to that, it was owned by Potlatch for many years. The dam was built in 1888, has had some renovations since 1888, and updates and upgrades. There was a recent inspection done that showed that there's a 1.5 million concrete face that needs some repair. And then all the inspections have now been completed. I just found out there was a delay in the inspections because of the weather, but Mr. Wicklund has indicated that the inspections have all been completed, and we have a final report from the DNR. Basically, members, any dam that is going to go to a public entity that used to be private has to statutorily be approved by the legislature. So that's what we have before you today. Brainerd wants to buy the dam. The city of Brainerd wants to purchase the dam. And with that, I will, and so we, that's what House File 2317 is all about. And without further ado, I'll just turn it over to my testifiers to either give you a little bit more information. Mr. Chair, we have more information. I also will say that the DNR has a report that they turned into, statutorily has to have a report in order for this to happen. So we have that report turned into us, and I will have my testifiers now either give more information and will be available for questions, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to our committee, and please state your name for the tape, and if you can do a quick testimony, we should be able to get through this rather quickly.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Patrick Wussel, City Administrator for the City of Brainerd. Representative Ward did an excellent job about our presentation, and I think we're here to answer your questions.
Any questions for members of the Representative Dill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, it's coming to my committee next. Are you really sure you want it?
Mr. Wausau.
That's my question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, we are positive. The City Council actually met last night, and we negotiated a lower price from our November purchase agreement based upon the studies that were done, and the Council is committed.
Representative Dill.
And the City Council, from time to time, in my experience, in other cities, doesn't really have communication with the citizens in the town and the city. Some people find out about it afterwards. So my question is there some, not consensus, but is there underlying support in the town of Brainerd to get this done?
Todd Wicklund, the Finance Director for Brainerd Public Utilities.
Welcome, Mr. Wicklund. And
yes, we started this process last July to potentially buy the dam. We've worked through the primary reason we were looking at it was the generation that could be gained, the savings that Brainerd could gain from what they're doing right now and buying from a wholesale supplier. As in any project that we're involved with, it's not 100%, no matter what. We have met with several of the concerned, the former employees that were there at one time or another that worked at the dam. We had them come in. We had them speak to our engineering company with the different issues. When we got done with the discussion, all those items were put on our list of things to look at, and they were, you know, at that time they were happy that at least we were addressing them, that we've taken it into account, that either it's something that, you know, either we'll look at as a maintenance item or as a capital item going down the road.
Any further questions? Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first question I have is a procedural one. Maybe Ms. Dyson can help. A brief here says, or inaction by the legislature for that session would allow the project to proceed. So does state law suggest that if we're entertaining this topic and we don't have action on it, they could proceed? And if that's the case, the question would be, why are we expending energy, Representative Ward, if they're going to have the authority in the end anyway?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ward.
And that's a great question, Representative Skolsky. Thank you for that. And here's the reason. You're absolutely correct. There's two ways that this can happen. Either through legislation allowing the city to, and if you read the bill, it says the city of Brainerd may purchase a dam, to your question, Representative Dill, as well, that they studied it. And then secondly, if we don't prohibit the sale and do nothing, that could still happen. Here's the reason that we are trying to do it legislatively, or we are doing it legislatively, is that we want to move this faster. If we wait until the session is done, our statutory, I think, ending date is May 19th, I think, somewhere around that, mid-May. Even if we finish earlier, you know, that still is into, you know, whenever. So we believe that through legislation, we can get it done quicker, sooner. And the city, and that's what the city has advocated and wants.
Senator Skowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ward or others, what price are you looking at here? And then the other question related to that, of course, is why is government needing to step in here? Is the private sector not interested in this dam, or are we going to be subsidizing the dam? Your city will be subsidizing the operation of the dam, or why isn't the private sector able to do this?
Mr. Wicklund, I
the first question had to do with the previous question had to do with the reason why we would want to move this forward is that there's a major project that has to be done there this spring. It has to be bid out. It has to be done. FERC is required that the apron be repaired. And if we wait later into the late spring and early summer, we probably would miss the bidding season getting the right price to do that project. And so we would complicate that thing with dealing with FERC on getting that job done. As to public versus private owning the dam, the reason that we're looking at it is that an opportunity came up. It's within the city limits of Brainerd. And when we bid on it last year, our wholesale supplier, Minnesota Power, did not bid on it. They said, go for it. I mean, it's in your jurisdiction. Go for it. And so based on that and based on our rising cost that we've had with Minnesota Power over the years, that's the reason why we're looking at it. Our cost per kilowatt hour is going to be less in a generation than what we're buying. And so that's the primary reason that we'd be interested in it. I don't know how many other bidders were in it when WASOP put it out there, but we were one of those that put our name in the hat, and we were the successful for bidder. And we have reduced the price. We initially was at $4.1 million down to $2.6 million based on some of the things that we will have to do this spring related to the project.
Representative Skowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And last question, Mr. Chair, and that would be, is the dam running now, and is it providing electricity? And so it is going, but it's up for sale, and the question is the city going to buy it and provide somehow a lower price? I don't know. I would suspect there's some sort of subsidy in order to make that happen. Or is the is Minnesota Power going to buy it?
No.
Mr. Whitman.
The process is that we would buy it. It generates about 3 megawatts of power when everything is running. There's 5 generators running. They're all running right now. Granted, you know, in the summer they may be less because it's a run of the river. It's based on the elevation. You have to keep it at a certain height. The savings to be had is the difference in price with Minnesota. The subsidy would be that as every year I have to look at rate adjustments with Minnesota Power. They're raising our cost of power. And with having this hydro would be about 10% of our load, our base needs. And so by buying this, generating this power, it's going to save, you know, at the tune of maybe $300,000 a year on Brainerd's power bills. And so what it would mean is if I normally have to raise everybody's rates 5%, based on my wholesale power agreement with AMP, and if I can do some of this at a cheaper rate, my rate adjustment may be only 3%. So it's a reduction. It's basically a hedging against the rate increases that we have with our current wholesale power provider.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. I was meeting with another chair to discuss a bill, and I maybe missed something here, but I guess first question is, if this is dealing with electric issues, is it going to be going to the Energy Committee?
going to the Environment Committee, Representative Falk.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess for the city, I walked in this a little bit late, maybe answered this already, but do you currently have a municipal power agency in place?
Mr. Wassa.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paul, yes, the city has a what we call the Brainerd Public Utilities. They provide all the water for the city of Brainerd, but their electric utility actually expands into the city of Baxter and surrounding area.
Okay.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is that a franchise agreement with another power supplier, or are you basically out there negotiating and able to purchase on open market and kind of do all the other things that you know another utility would offer?
Mm-hmm. Representative, or Mr. Wicklund?
Yeah. Is there, right now we have a power agreement with Minnesota Power, so everything that we wouldn't be generating at the hydro facility would be bought through Minnesota Power. We have our own service territory, has been mentioned. We cover all of our area, some of the neighboring city of Baxter, and in some of the areas that are outside of the city limits. So, and we continue to work on our service territory and negotiations with the co-op that's in the area.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess,
Representative.
So would this facility operate under like a network resource, an energy resource? Would it be under like a distributed generation tariff? What are the interconnection procedures that would allow you to operate it?
Mr. Wicklund.
Well, right now is it envisioned that all of the generation from this facility would just go into our distribution system within the city? So none of it would actually make it back to the MISO grid. It would all be used within the city of Brainerd's. Power distribution.
Thank you. So,
Representative Falk.
I guess to that question, do you know kind of what your MVA limit for the city would be? And just to make sure that you're not getting power flows back up onto the transmission system. I mean, I understand 3 megawatts isn't a very large facility, but when you've got potentially low peaks and just making sure that you're fully utilizing everything at your local substation so you don't have to go through those interconnection procedures.
Mr. Wicklund.
Right, I guess I'm not understanding exactly what the question.
What would be the MVA, or basically the, the amount of power that you would that substation uses at a base level? So, and if you've got 3 megawatts of generation, if you have less MVA usage than that, so to speak, at that substation, you've got no issue with it in the transmission system. But if you have points that drop below that, you potentially could have power going back onto the transmission system, okay. Which would facilitate you having to go through some type of interconnection procedure.
Mr. Wickle, the plant is currently up and operating and putting into the power grid system. Now, is it not? So that's already being taken care of.
Right. Yeah. Generally, the power that's coming in from our main substation is, our peak during the summer is like 45 to 50 megawatt load coming into the city, and right now the power that's being generated there is flowing back through our distribution line, back to our main substation. And in theory, back into the grid, and Minnesota Power is buying it.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, if that is, this just on the face of it seems like it's a case where you probably wouldn't be hitting transmission issues, but right. If that was the case right there, then, even though it's operating, because you have to go through interconnection procedures and you have a separate entity here, you may have to go through either like a MISO process, or actually I've got some work that's being done on DG tariffs for interconnection within the state. But those haven't been updated in a number of years.
Any further questions? Anybody else needs to testify for or against in the audience? If not, I'll remove my motion that House File 2317 be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. The bill's referred.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
The next bill on our agenda today is... Look at me. House File 2450, Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, did you call the meeting to order officially?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
And just for anyone that may have come in late, again, we are not hearing the medical marijuana bill today. It's been pulled. House File 1818 has been pulled from our agenda. And before Representative Mahoney starts, I think this memo might have gone out to everybody, but there's been some issues with the amendment reduction, with the bill revisers bill drafting system was down, and any amendments, we're going to give some leeway for amendments that were being worked on when it went down, that for tomorrow's hearing, that we'll accept those So don't go out and write a bunch of amendments. Ones that were in the possession of the revisor's office before 10 o'clock this morning, we will accept tomorrow. It's a system issue. It's not any other. It's not an issue with people who are being late with their bills. Representative Mahoney, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I move that House File 2450 be re-referred to taxes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House File 2450 is a bill that will transfer a TIF district will make a change in a TIF district, but it will not change the size or the distribution of funds to other governmental entities. And I believe that is the reason it's here in your committee, is the how it would affect financing in a different particular district. This TIF district has been in effect since 1996 is when they bought the bonds. They're 7% bonds. We were appropriated $2.7 million a year a couple of years ago. We are looking to repurchase or to sell those, to pay off those 7% bonds and pay and buy 5% bonds at this particular time, and then use this money in the same TIF district and for the same purpose, which is to upgrade and improve the St. Paul River Center.
Any questions of the Chair Mahoney? Representative Skousky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Can you tell us, Representative, when was the TIF district originally developed and when does it expire?
Representative Mahoney.
As I said, it was developed in 1996, and it is due to expire, and I believe it's 2023.
Representative Skousky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe Representative Mahoney or Ms. Dyson can remind me how does it normally do these TIF districts get started, and what is the level of interaction that taxpayers have? Is it simply a city council decision, or what ability do the taxpayers have to speak in the development process of these TIF districts?
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Actually, that is all done here at the state capitol and with the city council, but I believe that's all dealt with in the tax committee, not in this particular committee.
It'd be a tax issue. Representative Skousky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, welcome to the committee. I just have a couple of questions of the genesis of the TIF district and why we wouldn't handle it a little bit differently on here. My experience with TIF districts is that once the improvements have been done and paid for, even if the district might have been longer, we would just, from the communities that I've been involved with and been the mayor of, we would decertify those and we would close them out and not necessarily move them from one area to another. And then if we saw another need, we would develop another TIF district for those particular needs. Why wouldn't that work in this area to close out the current TIF district and start a new TIF district for a new set of projects and then go through that process for public input and the like, instead of just transferring what's the balance of one area to a new area?
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, again, the reason this bill is in this particular committee is to assure the committee that no money that the other government entities are being held harmless with this TIF district, and all the other decisions are to be decided in the tax committee. This TIF district was extended, I believe it was last year, by the tax committee. We are funding, we are buying or paying off old bonds and repurchasing and lowering the interest rate. This bond purchase was going on for another 10 or 20 years, I think it's 20 years. And the money is being used for the same purpose that it was. We're just extending the TIF district to improve and remodel the River Center, as I said.
Representative.
So again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this TIF district and this fund is holding all other governmental entities that are involved with the TIF district harmless.
Representative Pepman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my question is probably for Ms. Dyson. I'm just wondering, the effective date says this section is effective without local approval under Minnesota statutes, section 645. And I'm just wondering, does this bill in any way, I'm wondering how it affects it. I'm wondering what that means. Is it the change is without local approval, or what is it that's without, that local approval isn't necessary? That it changed, to the year changed to 2009, and that the St. Paul change, or is it that is it something else?
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, the effective without local approval refers to the changes that are being made in this bill, and what it's referring to in 645.023 sub 1 paragraph A has to do with the fact that this is permissive legislation, and permissive legislation doesn't, under the Constitution, does not require local approval, although the legislature can still require, can say, yes, you have to have local approval, but it's a special law, but because it's permissive, it doesn't require local approval, and this is just stating that, and has the effect of making it effective August 1st of 2014.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. I know this is probably a question I could ask on Tax Committee, but I'm just wondering, Representative Mahoney said that this was extended by the Tax Committee last year as well, and so therefore we overlooked the local approval in Tax Committee last year. Is that correct? I suppose you're not tax, maybe you don't know, but...
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair Representative Pepin, this particular subdivision, at least, was not amended last year. This is from 2008, and so to be honest, I don't know if the rest of it had some change in last year, but the TIF bill or TIF provisions frequently have their own local approval requirements that are related to how they affect other districts, and the city may be in a better position to talk about,
Mr. Chair,
that, but
Representative Mahoney.
I misspoke, Mr. Chair, thank you. I misspoke. The legislature extended in 2008 to 2023.
Thank you, because I was on the Tax Committee last year, and I'm sure that I would have had some questions had I seen this last year.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to be clear, so what we're doing, and back to this effective date question that Representative Pepin had for Ms. Dyson, so what we're doing is the legislature is repurposing this TIF district, and then it's not going to actually be entertained by the St. Paul City Council? Is that what this means?
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, this is one of the priorities for the City of St. Paul, so the City Council has weighed in on this already.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So help me fully understand what line 1.14 on the bill means then. So we're going to approve repurposing of this TIF district, and who is not going to provide local approval when we do this?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Could you clarify your question? Because that didn't make sense to me.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, on line 1.14, effective date, it says this section is effective without local approval.
Ms. Dyson, you want to weigh in on that? Maybe you can give an answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, this particular provision in the effective date for local approval has to do with the City Council's, the requirement under law to file for the City Council to adopt a resolution that approves it and files it with the Secretary of State. That's what that provision is referring to. The City Council still has to take action to do any refunding of bonds or take, the City Council is still in charge of deciding to go ahead and do this refunding that is referred to in the bill draft, but the local approval section just has to do with a filing with the Secretary of State that they approve the law that authorizes them to do it.
Representative Scouse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Dyson. So Ms. Dyson is in that process of that filing, et cetera, with the Secretary of State that would be normal. Is there any citizen interaction? Are there any hearings or anything normally that would happen as part of that as well, or is it simply an administrative thing?
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, the local approval requirements, if the law requires, and this has to do with local laws, if the law requires a local approval, the City Council at its meeting would have to adopt a resolution, and it would be normal City Council procedures for presenting that this is legislation the legislature has, and usually it's in the context of mandatory legislation where the legislature is telling this, for example, if the legislature told the City of St. Paul, you must do this, then you have to have local approval where the City Council would decide, are we going to do it or not? And then in order for the law to actually take effect, the City Council would adopt a resolution saying, we approve that law that tells us we have to do something, and then they have to file it with the Secretary of State before the beginning of the next biennium for that law to take effect. If that local approval is not filed, then the law would never take effect, but it's in the context of mandatory legislation affecting a single unit of government. In the context of permissive legislation, there's no need for that process to say, yes, legislature, we will approve it. This has to do with the relationship between the legislature and the local government.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Again, anybody in the audience that needs to speak for or against this bill? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 2450 be referred to the Committee on Taxes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The ayes have it. Bill is referred. Thank you, Representative Mahoney. The next bill we have is Representative Hansen, House File 2311. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would move House File 2311 to
Environment Natural Resources Policy Committee.
To Environment Natural Resources Policy Committee. Members, House File 2311 deals with drainage inspectors, and I'm going to give you just a little bit of a background on the exciting world of drainage, because I
know see the audience is packed.
I know there's a lot of people in the room that. So drainage inspectors, what I'm amending is statute 103E.065, and some of you may have heard of drainage viewers, and there's a difference between drainage viewers and drainage inspectors. So in your packet I've included the statutory definition of drainage viewers. These are the folks who go out and do the evaluation for a redetermination of benefits. The drainage inspectors are the folks who examine the drainage systems. Essentially, they are the enforcement authority. So that's a difference between the people who do the viewing and the people who do inspecting. Now, as some of you know, I've been working in drainage issues for quite a while. I'm happy to have anybody else dive into that if they'd like to work on them. But there are some counties in Minnesota, there used to be more, where the county commissioner serves as the drainage inspector. And I view this as a government operations, good government thing. We don't have county commissioners inspecting nursing homes. We don't have county commissioners personally serving in the enforcement role. So what my bill is very simple. It says that county commissioners cannot serve as the drainage inspector.
Members, any questions? I see Representative O'Driscoll, Representative Pepin, afterwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, as intriguing as this is, I don't know if we still have the provision in statute, but when I was the mayor of Sartell, I had the dubious honor of being the weed inspector. And all I'd ever did was, because that was statutory requirement, so all we ever did was relegate that to our public works director. My thought is that similar to what would be happening at the county, that this would be regulated to someone within a public works department or an environmental services department within the county?
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, that is what's been happening over the last several years. The drainage inspector is more likely to be a professional trained staff person. However, the authority that allows the county commissioners to be the inspector is implicit. It is not explicit. So what my bill does is it provides an explicit prohibition that doesn't prohibit the county commissioners from designating or delegating that drainage inspection authority to an individual on staff or even another county or by contract.
Representative O'Driscoll.
So I'm just going to try this in plain English, what I thought I just heard you say. And that would be that the county still has the responsibility, the board still has the responsibility and the authority for inspection. We're going to assume that with this legislation, they will appoint the appropriate resource to be able to get that statutory requirement fulfilled.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, yes.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, I was just kind of curious, what about in really small communities, you know, maybe just where there's not the staff available or the expertise available? I'm just wondering if you've gotten any feedback or is there any concern that this might be problematic there?
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, I think the counties will testify. They have been checking with the various counties. This is a county task or another drainage authority, maybe a watershed district. So you will, I think the counties can speak for themselves. You may find some small counties or some counties where the county commissioner does this. I would just venture to say that with a county commissioner, you have continual changes with election. If you designate a staff person that can build the expertise, even if you're a small county or drainage authority, you would probably save money in the long run by having the designated person. In addition, the counties I know have gone through a lot of efforts with sharing staff or sharing tasks, and this I think would be an excellent one where if you have the expertise in an adjoining county, they could perhaps be used to do this.
And I see on our list we have Annalie Garlitz from the Association of Counties. Maybe she can answer some of the questions, and then after Ms. Garlitz speaks, I think they saw somebody coming up that wants to speak. And then we'll continue with questions. Ms. Garlitz, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Annalie Garlitz, and I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties. As you all know, and as you've already discussed, counties around the state vary greatly. This bill does have an impact. As Representative Hansen indicated, I've done a quick survey of county administrators and coordinators around the state, and we've heard back from a smaller number of counties that they've indicated that it will have an impact on them, and these counties are smaller rural counties. The counties and their elected officials have voiced concerns, and they feel that utilizing county commissioners is cost effective and saves the cost of extra staff or consultants. They've also indicated that they feel that they have a familiarity with the land and the constituents they are dealing with and want to continue to act as the drainage inspector in those counties. I've shared these concerns with Representative Hansen, and I would like to continue talking with him to understand his concerns and to further understand the full impact of what this bill would have on other small counties that may have not responded back to our request earlier this last week. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Garlitz. And the other gentleman I saw, is there anybody else that wants to speak for or against this? I guess I misunderstood. Representative Pepin, continue with your questioning. Ms. Garlitz, you may want to stay here because she may have a question.
I don't think I do, but...
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But her concerns are kind of what I was getting at, and it seems, I guess, so I have two questions, and so my first would be, in light of what she just had to say, with the impact this could have on small counties where they just don't have the expertise, perhaps, why is this needed? And then my second question is, you testified that commissioners don't inspect nursing homes, and in Hennepin County, I'm guessing they don't inspect the HCMC. So then do we need to put that in statute as well that says they're not allowed to, or they're prohibited from inspecting nursing homes, or prohibited from all the things they're prohibited from? Or is that not necessary? Will we expect that later? Because I'm not quite sure why this is needed. And so if you can just give me your feedback on if we need to specify for those other areas.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, I don't believe that for example, in Hennepin County, they've exerted or attempted to exert any authority for those inspections. This is something where there are and have a long history of county commissioners who have done this. Many counties have moved away from that model to have the professional staff do that inspection. Why is this needed? Frankly, it's I believe it's a conflict of interest for the county commissioner to do that enforcement task. I think that if you have professional staff do it, they are removed from that decision making, and they can have the training and the expertise that can do the evaluation with the inspection, and then the decision still rests ultimately with the county commissioners on or the drainage authority on that. Okay. But to have the elected official as the enforcement person, the individual who goes out and does the inspection, I believe that's improper. And I don't think, just to take it to us, our example, as elected officials, would we have the authority to go out, would it be proper for us to have the authority to go out in an enforcement role, an inspector role, on any of the things that we do? This is something that is a past practice that most of the counties who have drainage have moved away from, and I think we should go further to explicitly prohibit that and have the professional staff. As you know, drainage is very controversial, and if it goes to litigation, I think to remove any perception of a conflict by having professional trained staff provide this and go through the process for the county commissioners to make the ultimate decision rather than being the inspector is a good government result.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just kind of curious. I'm wondering, when you put language in that's saying they must not do that, then for everything else, does that mean then they could come forward and say, well, it doesn't specifically say that I can't be the nursing home inspector, which probably wouldn't happen in Hennepin County, but maybe it would in a smaller county. So then if it's not specifically listed, wouldn't then that mean that those things are allowed? That's why I'm wondering if we need to add every possible thing that the county commissioner shouldn't be doing. Because to me, you're kind of opening up a box of worms here.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, I am not attempting to amend any other statutes. It's very, on its face, plain language what I'm doing here. It's only the drainage inspectors, which I believe if you look at the history on the statute, it was last changed in 1990. So we're almost 25 years. Just because things were this way, I think we can move forward after 25 years and make sure we have professional trained staff doing this. Again, drainage is very controversial, often litigated. To have those staff, have staff provide that expertise with the ultimate decision authority making be with the county commissioners, I believe is where we should be in 2014.
Representative Freiberg.
I was actually going to make exactly the same point as Representative O'Driscoll. When I was on the City Council, the first thing we would do each year is appoint a couple assistant weed inspectors that were in the public works staff. So if Representative O'Driscoll would like to work on a comparable weed inspector bill, I'd be happy to work with him on that.
Any further questions? Again, anybody in the audience that wants to speak for or against this bill? If not, Representative Hansen?
Thank you. I would encourage a yes vote and
so Representative
the conversation.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 2311 be re-referred to the Committee on Environment, Natural Resources Policy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The ayes have it. The bill's referred. Thank you, Representative. And Mike, you want to step over here? The next bill on the agenda is House File 2663. The Met Council Obsolete Provisions Bill, and it's my bill. Representative Freiberg will take over the chair.
This goes to transportation policy.
Good to see you.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Would you like to move that your bill be recommended to go to transportation policy?
I'll move that House File 2663 be recommended to be re-referred to the Transportation Policy Committee. And
thank you. I'd like to explain your bill.
Members, This is one of the bills that's under the has come forth under the governor's unsession proposals, and another one I carried that was just four ended up just being four repealers. This is a little more comprehensive, and if you look at your bill summary, it describes it pretty well. But basically, it's getting rid of redundant language, past dates, repealing stuff that no longer affects the county or the Met Council. And if I can go through here, section number one, was enacted in 1994 when the MTC, the West Wastewater Control Board, the RTB were all merged into the Met Council. And there's dates specific in there, and it's no longer necessary. Section two, again, it was something that was when the councils were merged, and it was enacted in 1994. And again, when the councils are merged, it's no longer necessary. It's ongoing. They're doing this. Number three, the Met agencies. It was something that was supposed to be done in 1985. It's been done, and it's ongoing. And so we can repeal that section of law. Number four has to do with changing from the different types of transit modes that are out there to calling it rolling stock. This is an industry term that defines buses, trains, anything that's on wheels that moves. It defines all those. It's part of the industry term. Again, section five has to do with rural certificates. It has a date in it that's been passed. Section number six is dealing with parks. It's language related to an obsolete HUD standard and a HUD program that's no longer in effect, so we can get rid of that also. The affordable life housing, section number seven, deals with strikes a date and language tied to dates that have passed. Section number eight, similar thing, it's dates that have been passed. Section nine, the same, strikes obsolete language and specific dates that have been passed. You can see there's a general theme here going on. Section 10 is referring to implementing agencies, and it is basically the language is in the bill. References the section of law that lists these implementing agencies. Section 11 is about a ride-sharing program. The council, under their general authority, has the authority to establish these advisory committees, and so the language is no longer necessary. Section 12 has to do with the bus garage that was going to be built. It's been since been built. This was from 1998. The garage that's north of Pennsylvania Avenue or Palin Boulevard, just east of 35E, and it's already up and running, so we don't need the language anymore. Section 13 deals with contracting for a specific route on a specific place. The agency, again, has the authority to do that with their routes, and so it's no longer necessary language. Section 14, again, is acquisition of transit systems. This, again, goes back to 1970 to the former Metropolitan Transit Commission, which is no longer in existence, and so that can be repealed. Number 15, Section 15, just updates the name of the agency to what it currently is being called, so it's just a minor change. Section 16 talks about grants, gifts for the wastewater system. These grants have not been available since 1980, and so it's no longer necessary to have it in law. Section 17, surplus property waste in the wastewater system. Again, it's redundant language, and it's covered by current statute 473.5111. Section 18, again, it strikes the date that it passed. 19, 20, and 21, all strikes dates that it passed. And number 22, we get to number 22, the repealers, and Representative Pepin mentioned that there's a lot of repealers in this bill. And the first repealer has to do with an authority to counsel higher performance and budget analysis, and that's something we've never done.
Mr. Chair, my name is Judd Shedd, and I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. Thank you for the opportunity to be here, and if you'd like, I could walk through the repealers if the committee would prefer.
Why do we want?
We can just take them one by one if you'd like. Would that be okay with you, Representative? Great. Okay. So first of all, thank you, Mr. Chair, for taking the bill, and again, what we're trying to achieve here is clean up our statutes to get rid of old and obsolete language. We have a number of these are remnants from the merger of the three, the Metropolitan Water Commission, the Regional Transportation Board, and the Metropolitan Transit Commission. So a lot of these are old and obsolete. So the first piece, the first repealer is 473.123 subdivision 7, and what that does, it repeals a performance and budget analysis, and the provision was enacted in 1994 at the time when the legislature abolished those three commissions. And the council has never hired these performance and budget analysts, but we do have the general authority currently under chapter 473.129 to hire these types of analysts if we choose to do so. So it's something that we haven't done. It goes back over 20 years, and if we chose to hire those analysts, we would be able to do that under our current authority. So again, for the purposes of cleaning up statute and clarity, we felt that this would be a good subject to be repealed. The second repealer is 473.13 subdivision 1.3. This deals with a report on consultants. We believe this is kind of overly prescriptive and unnecessary. It was enacted in 2001. However, our current budget language, which is on 473.129, let me find this here, states that the council, as part of our annual budgeting, must state in detail the expenditures for each program that we have, including the expenses for salaries, consultants, services, overhead, traveling, printing, and other items. So we believe that that is covered in that particular area of statute. And so, again, we'd find that to be redundant. Chapter, or I guess it's 473.23, which is the third repealer, we believe is obsolete. We prepared this inventory of public facilities many, many years ago, and if it should become necessary for the council to do this in the future, we have that authority under Chapter 473.242. And we also believe that Subdivision 2 is unnecessary because the comprehensive plan amendment, where the council reviews these local comprehensive plan amendments when we address land use changes. So, again, we are just removing obsolete and redundant language. The next repealer is 473.241, and that repeals a data collection statute. We believe that this is unnecessary as well because the council already maintains a data center and library and works cooperatively with the university and state agencies on an ongoing basis, and we don't believe that we need this statute in order to conduct that. So again, we're just trying to clarify and reduce statutory language. The repealer is 473.243, which deals with emergency services. The council never provided these services or actually performed those functions, and in fact, we believe that other agencies are better suited to perform these services and functions. And I just would like to let the committee know that in the month leading up to the legislative session, we did have an opportunity to sit down with Chair Nelson and Representative Pepin, Representative Sanders, and Representative Scott to walk through these repealers and the bill, and we wanted to make sure that if there were any questions that we would be able to address them, and we were able to address a couple of the questions that Representative Pepin and Representative Scott raised at the time. So again, the intent of this bill is to be there's nothing in here that we believe to be substantial in any matter, and if there is, we're happy to have that conversation. I'll keep going on the repealers. Chapter 473.244 repeals special studies and reports. This section was enacted in 1967 when the council was established, and we were given some responsibilities for coordinating regional planning. And what we're asking here is to repeal this section to remove that obsolete language. And if it was necessary for the council to conduct any research, we have that current authority under Chapter 473.242. So again, we are just clarifying, getting rid of old language, and if the council or legislature felt it was necessary for us to conduct that, we have the current authority today under 473.242. The next one, 473.254 subdivision 3, repeals subdivision 3 of the local housing incentives account. We are deleting it because it is date specific and obsolete, and the requirements in that section have been fulfilled. On the next one, 473.315 subdivision 2 repeals grants for open recreation space and immediate grants that were, again, that is obsolete and can be repealed because the provision was originally intended to make it possible for the council to make park grant funding available before the council had an opportunity to adopt its first recreation open space policy plan. The council never did that. The council does not make those grants. And again, this is old, obsolete language that we would like just out of the statutes in order to reduce any confusion that people may have. The parks implementing agencies are the agencies that handle the park grants, and the council acts as a pass-through. Chapter 473.326 repeals Como Zoo Park bonds, and this is obsolete as well. It was used once in the mid-1970s when no state funds were appropriated for the regional park system capital projects, and then in beginning in 1976, those bonds were appropriated for capital projects, and so that is how those parks in Como Park and other parks have been funded since that time, and those bonds that were made possible in the 1970s were retired almost 20 years ago. So again, there is no reason to keep this language in statute. The next repealer is 473.333 that deals allows the council to acquire land for the regional park system. Again, we do not do that. The regional park agencies do that. So again, to clarify, that the council does not want that authority or need that authority. We're asking for it to be repealed under the idea that it makes for clarity and efficiencies. 473.375, subdivision 9 deals with advisory committees. This section is not mandatory, and we believe that that can be eliminated as well because the council has general authority to appoint advisory committees under statute 473.127. So again, this is a redundancy, and since it's permissive in the first place and we have the ability to appoint these advisory committees in another section of statute, we are just clarifying and cleaning up the statute and are asking to remove that. 473.382 deals with the local planning and development program, and we're asking that it be deleted as well. This language traces back to 1984 and really was applied to the Regional Transportation Board. The council engages with local communities through our work as the Metropolitan Planning Organization, and so that ability for us to interact with local governments exists through our MPO functions. And further, when we move forward and do transit planning, we have regular contact with cities and community groups on, to inform our planning anyway. And the council also has employed many outreach opportunities and collaboration with city staff and elected officials when we bring forward major projects similar to what we're doing right now with Southwest, what we're doing with the Central Corridor, or any time we restructure a particular area of a bus or transit service. So that is all covered under our current authority as the MPO. Subdivision 8 of Chapter 473.388 deals with replacement service and an incentive for replacement services. This goes back to the suburban transit providers or the opt-out providers, as other folks know them. This is not rattling anybody. We just want to make sure that what we're doing is clarifying that what happened prior to 2001, when Representative Abrams and Senator Pogamiller passed the tax bill, they took transit off of the property tax and moved us to the motor vehicle sales tax. And at that point, when we were taking the entire metropolitan area transit system off of property tax, that made this provision in law obsolete because this deals with funds that were tied back to the property tax. And since we have not been funded under that fashion for, you know, over 12 years, again, this is a cleanup to allow us to get that old and stale language out of statute. And I'm happy to take any questions about that, but again, this is completely benign and just clarifying old and getting rid of that old language. Chapter 473.392 deals with service bidding. It is obsolete. It really applied to the Regional Transportation Board, which was abolished in 1994. The council does things today through our RFP process, and we also have to follow all FTA procurement requirements and council adopted policies and state law when it comes to our transit procurement. Chapter 473.516, subdivision 5, relates to sludge ash contracts. It's kind of strange that we have one particular piece of law related to contracting for sludge ash. We believe that it is unnecessary because we have general authority to enter into contracts related to the operations of our wastewater treatment system in statute already. So to have this particular citation, we believe, is unnecessary. 473.523, subdivision 2, deals with the manager's authority. It really deals with the wastewater manager's authority. The subdivision was enacted several years ago and really applied again to the Metropolitan Waste Control Commission. When it was abolished in 1994, its duties were transferred to the council, and that subdivision again is unnecessary because the council competitively procures goods and services under our current procedures. So and it's important to note that we apply this even for goods and services that fall below the threshold amounts that are in the Uniform Municipal Contracting Law. So even though there's a threshold, if we have a contract that falls below that $100,000 threshold, we still go through the procurement process. So we're actually making it, we believe, we're making it better for the taxpayer. Under 473.535, it repeals a section that is duplicative. It applies to the council to issue debt for the acquisition and betterment of wastewater facilities. We do not need that language because it's specific to wastewater. And in 1994, again, when the council was merged, we were giving that authority under new council statutes that allowed us to issue debt and to make sure, let me see here, to issue debt and acquire land for the betterment of the metropolitan wastewater facilities. So again, it's redundant. It goes back to the Municipal Water Commission, and we are just trying to get that out of statute so we are more clear about that. Under 473.852, subdivision 11, we are asking to repeal that language because it is unnecessary. Those provisions that were part of the Metropolitan Land Planning Act that required school districts to submit their capital plans to the council were repealed in 2006. So, again, those are over 8 years old, and there is no reason for them to remain in statute. This falls under the idea that we are trying to clarify and provide clarity over what the council has authority over, and we feel that making sure that school districts know that they don't have to come before the council would probably be a good idea. The last repealer I have deals with advisory committees, again, and the council has the authority to establish and appoint advisory committees under section 473 or statute 473.127. So again, that is just to clarify, we don't need additional areas of statute that allow us to appoint advisory committees when we have the general authority under 473.127. I know I ran through that very quickly, and I'm sure there are questions, so I'm happy to take any of those questions that you may have.
Representative Pepin.
Thanks. Mr. Chair, I have many questions throughout the bill. I don't know if any, I'd just like to run through with more detail, especially on the part that went through rather quickly. So could I have the your blessings to ask several questions?
Sure.
Thank you. Whoever would like these questions, Representative Nelson, the first part I'll ask questions about is the non-repealer part, and then I'm going to ask some repealer questions. So whoever wants to answer these. On page 2, lines 2.4 to 2. 2.7, I think Representative Nelson, you said, or one of you two said that they're already doing this so we can repeal it, and my concern is about transparency, and how does the public know? I'm just wondering, when you say you're already doing it now, is that reflected somewhere else? Because just because you're doing it now doesn't mean you couldn't stop doing it, or that you won't stop doing it. And so I'm just wondering how will there be transparency for the public?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I will take that question. So what we are doing in that statute is the budget requirements in that section were enacted in 1994 when the legislature abolished the Transit Commission, the Metropolitan Waste Control Commission, and the Regional Transportation Board. And those authorities were transferred to the council. And the budget requirements, we believe, are unnecessarily and overly prescriptive because the council's operating capital budgets, our work program, and capital improvement program are subject to our oversight by the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Governance. And we also have those as part of our annual budget that we prepare under Chapter 473.13. So, again, we are thinking that it's a little over prescriptive. When Chapter 473.13 again says that our budget shall state in detail the expenditures for each program to be undertaken, and it's called out, including the expenses for salaries, consultant services, overhead, travel, printing, and other items. And we do have a specific area that deals with the chair's office and regional administrator's office where the council members would be found. So when we bring forward our budget that we present to the Oversight Commission, which for members in the audience, there are 14 members of the legislature, 4 from the House and Senate majorities, 3 from the House and Senate minorities, that we have to submit our annual, our draft budgets, capital and operating budgets, and walk through that with them prior to adopting our budget, generally the first or second week in December. So we have that opportunity to share, and the legislature has the opportunity to go through that, but it is also made available on our webpage at any point. So we are not reducing anything. We are actually that we would consider this redundant. And again, just for the idea of trying to clarify statute, we feel that having it mentioned twice is unnecessary.
Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Shetton, I see what you're saying. It does seem a little bit like it's more you're looking to get permission after the fact rather than before in that section. So I'm not sure that I agree that it's completely redundant. I understand that it's available, but to me it just looks a little bit like instead of sort of outlining what your budget is, you're just saying we're going to provide the actual necessary expenses. So I agree that it's probably there. I'm just not sure that I like the format that it's in now. The next question I have, though, and Representative Nelson, you went through this a little quickly, so perhaps you mentioned it, but that section 473.125, it talks about the regional administrator, and the section kind of looked like there's some kind of a new regional administrator czar, and if you could talk a little bit about the intention of what you're trying to do there, that would be helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin. I'll handle the question if that's okay with you.
Mr. Shaw.
The piece that deals with the regional administrator, I'm going to talk to lines 2.23.2.26, if you're okay with that. It was added in 1994 when the duties and responsibilities of the three commissions, the MTC, MWCC, and the Regional Transportation Board were transferred to the council. And we believe that clause was probably added it was intended to facilitate the transition of those former agencies' employees to the council, but it isn't necessary anymore because the council applies its personnel policies on an agency-wide basis. So this goes back to when those three agencies were brought together. Now we are just clarifying that employees of the wastewater services and transit operations were appointed, disciplined, and discharged in according with council personnel policies by their respective operations managers and the Metropolitan Transit Police officers, that they all fall under the authority of the agency-wide personnel policies and that they shouldn't be held out separately because we have a agency-wide personnel policy.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your tolerance with me because I know I had several questions during our other meetings as well. but I think it does help to the committee to understand what exactly is happening. And my next question is on section 4 on page 3.
Yep.
And it has to do with the best value determination. And it says the evaluation criteria must be included in the solicitation document. And before it said the evaluation criteria detailed in the solicitation document. So I'm, I guess a couple of things are going on here, and I'm wondering if this section lessens the importance of price, and also if it makes it less the when you're changing the word from detailed to must be included, does that make the criteria less clear? Because I think at least for best value when you're talking about construction projects, which you know I know that's a little different, but. I think there's been a lot of confusion as to what the criteria is. I've heard from some contractors, so I'm just wondering, I want to make sure that doesn't happen, that the detail, that when you take out the word detailed, that you're not just saying must include it. If you're not clear as to, is it 80% of the determination, is it 10% of the determination? And just wondering what your intent is and if you're worried at all that it might do that.
Great. Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, this language came from our procurement division, and they asked us to pursue this just for clarity reasons and how we apply the best value procurement. And I believe when we say a best value determination must be based on the evaluation criteria detailed in the solicitation document, which would be current language, I think by saying the evaluation criteria must be included in the solicitation document as well as the relative importance of price and factors gets to your point, and that they're wanting to make sure that that is a part of whatever determination you're making.
So it's listed somewhere,
Yes, I believe it is. It has to be in any type of part of our RFPs that we put out. And I'm happy to follow up with you and bring our procurement folks up to visit with you to make sure that that is how it is working here, because, again, our purpose of bringing this bill forward is we want nothing that is controversial or nothing that that members don't understand, because if there is an issue, and after we potentially talk to you, if there continues to be an issue, we could pull this language. There's nothing in here that we want to give the impression that we're trying to bring forward that would cause any type of consternation. So if that's okay with you, it might be best for me to bring our procurement person up and talk to you about it.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shetton, I think that's fine. I just want to be sure that it's clear so that everybody knows what everybody's clear what the rules are of the game, I guess. My next question is on page 8, section 17 on surplus property. You took a bunch of statute out about how the property will be sold. And so I'm just wondering if, since that's going to be taken out, how will it be sold? Will it be listed to the public? Or, I mean, how? I'm just worried that it could be sold in a manner that may lead to, you know, that could lead to people selling it to family members or just not as transparent. So I'm just wondering what the intention there.
We're talking 8. Section 17.
Yeah, the surplus property.
And the notes I have here, that's already covered under statute 473.5111.
Okay.
Statute that's described how they have to do it. That's standard. 473.504.
Okay.
Any follow-up, Mr. Shetnan?
Mr. Chair, and thank you for your patience. I was trying to find my notes here. That section is specific to the Council's Environmental Services Division, which is our wastewater treatment facility or wastewater treatment division. And we believe that isn't necessary because Section 473, as Representative Nelson said, .511, governs reconveyance and the disposition of any interceptors that are no longer needed for the regional wastewater treatment system. And I can tell you that this goes back to 1999, 2000, 2001 area. Representative Biskins carried that reconveyance bill for me in the House. So we believe that this isn't necessary because that chapter that deals with reconveyance covers that piece.
So
that's how we would dispose of that surplus property.
So I couldn't just acquire a wastewater treatment plant if I felt like it? Sorry, you don't have to answer that. So, Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I think that's all for the bill part, and then I just had some questions in the repealer. On the first two repealers, 473.123 and 473.13, the first one, you mentioned that it was enacted in 1994 and you'd never hired the position, and I'm just wondering why, or if there's another, if there are other practice in place to measure performance, because I think that's, you know, perhaps an important position if you need to have someone to look at the performance and have the functions of budget and analyst, and then so that just kind of why don't you do that?
Yep.
And then the second part, and then for the 0.13, I just want to, I think you said that this was covered elsewhere, especially the total cost of the contract and the source of the funds used to pay for the contracts, and I just want to verify that that's indeed what you said, that that's just redundant, it's covered elsewhere.
Madam Chair, or excuse me, no. Mr. Chair.
Next year, Mr. Chair, next year.
Anyway, again, 473.123 is permissive language, and they've never done it. They may hire. It's covered that, and they do this as part of their analyzing of their budget anyway, but that's permissive language, not a must. And in 473.13, this is already covered in 473.129. So it's redundant language.
Okay. Just a quick question. Are any other members going to have questions on this? I just want to make sure we have time. I know we do have a room reserved for tonight. Representative O'Driscoll is. Would you like to continue, Representative Pepin?
It doesn't matter. I have a few more for the repealers, but I can wait. But I don't think you answered my first question, though, about why hasn't the Met Council ever hired anyone to do a performance and budget analyst position?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I am not exactly sure why the council hasn't done that. However, it is permissive, and it looks like our regional administrator is on his way up. He can maybe speak to that.
And then, Mr. Chair, if you'd like to take other members' questions, I just do have a couple other questions on the repealers.
Mr. Chair, why don't we let her finish her questions and...
Sure, that'd be fine. I'm sorry, please identify yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Pat Bourne. I'm the regional administrator. What this section does is to repeal language we've never used, that's true. But what the language provides for is that the governing body, the council itself, would hire employees who are performance analysts and budget analysts. We've chosen to hire those disciplines. We do have people who do budget work and do performance work, but they're not employees who are supervised by the governing board itself. Those are folks who are supervised by our other managers or me in some cases. So we do have those disciplines in the council and in our divisions, but they don't report to the council itself. Should the council want to do that, if they choose to do that, they can do that, but they don't need this authority to do that. We have other statutory authority that we would rely on to do that. So our choice in putting this in front of you is to simply say we don't use this. If the council itself wanted people that would report to them directly rather than through the administrator, they can do that and don't need. We don't think they need this authority to do that.
Thank you. It sounds like you do it, and that's what I was just curious, because it seems like it's important stuff. And then I don't have that many more questions. I think some of them are just I want to be sure that I understand it properly, maybe like two or three that I can probably double up on. I think, Mr. Shetnin, on two or three that I can probably double up on. I think, Mr. Shetnin, on 473.333, it had to do with council acquisitions, and you said that the Met Council doesn't acquire land or water area, and the regional parks do it, which is true. But I'm just wondering then, does the Met Council not have the ability to acquire land, or they just don't do it?
Mr. Shetnin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin. The council does have that authority. We have the authority here before us, but the council has never used that authority, and we do not own or operate regional park facilities. The council helps fund these through the money that we get through the legislature, and this particular provision dates back to 1975, which was at the beginning of the Regional Recreation and Open Park Space Commission when it was first initiated. So Again, we're talking about language that dates back decades ago, and by trying to repeal this particular section, we're trying to clarify, again, that the council does not want this authority. We do not need this authority. That is covered by the park implementing agencies, and it's, again, to clarify and make sure that there isn't any confusion into the future, because the legislature has passed specific language outlining that the park implementing agencies are the entities responsible for that. So, again, we're just trying to get rid of that language to reduce any type of confusion.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. I think probably just one more question, and it has to do with 473.388, and then also just a clarifying question on 473.392 on page 4R. Just to clarify, on the replacement service program section 3.388, you talked about how the funding used to be through property taxes, and it's not anymore, and we made that change. But I just want to make sure that this doesn't, I think you said it didn't affect anybody, and it's clarifying and obsolete, but I just want to verify that there is no impact on any of the opt-outs, such as Maple Grove and Transit. Okay, I see a no. And then that's perfect. That's what I wanted to hear. And then I know you went through this one, and I got distracted for a minute. I was talking to somebody. The 473.392, the council may competitively bid transit service. So just wondering how this will be done now. Why that, I just missed it, and why you said that was necessary.
Great. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin. If you'd like, I could speak to the special replacement service piece as well with a little bit more detail. That section of law referred to the pre-MVS days. Again, it goes back to the tax bill in 2001, I believe, when opt-outs were receiving 90% of their local property tax funds to run their own transit services. Under this section, they were eligible to receive an additional 2% of the property tax serving an increasing number of trips originating outside of their service areas and commuting to job centers within a new community. So, and then because the opt-outs are now guaranteed a specific share of motor vehicle sales tax that was created as part of the tax bill, I believe it is 3.471% of the overall motor vehicle sales tax, they are no longer receiving property tax, and therefore having this particular statutory citation is just confusing, and it is obsolete. So I can guarantee you that there is no impact to not only Maple Grove, but to MBTA, Plymouth, Shakopee, Scott County, any of those opt-out providers. So it is, again, just a pure repealer that gets rid of obsolete language. On your question regarding, I believe it was 473.392 with the service bidding, again, this comes from our procurement folks, and they believe that is obsolete because it applied to the Regional Transportation Board when it was abolished in 1994. And the council does not procure transit services by bid because there are other factors that, other than price, that are brought into the procurement process. And the council has competitively procured transit service under an RFP proposal for many, many, many years, basically going back to when the council was reorganized. And the council's competitive procurement process has to be consistent with the FTA standards, the state laws, and any council policies. So the service bidding is just kind of a dinosaur in this area. So just, and our procurement folks asked us to bring this forward just to relieve any type of confusion about that.
This is going to transportation policy, too, so I imagine these issues could be fleshed out there.
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding as well, so thank you.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can we go back to talking about inspectors, county inspectors? That seemed to be a little bit more my purview, coming from greater Minnesota and not being covered by the Met Council. But I do have one question, and it's lines 314 through 316. It says transit vehicles means, and then we strike the words buses, coaches, motor rail locomotives, and coach cars, light rail vehicles, paratransit vehicles. What's left?
Mr. Chair.
It would be covered under rolling stock.
Chair Nelson.
Mr. Chair, that's what I said when we went through this. The industry term for all those is rolling stock. So rolling stock includes all those things that are that you listed there that are in current law. It's just the general term. Anything that's used for transit if they, we decide to go back to buggies and horse and buggies, it would be covered because it's considered rolling stock.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there anything that's in the definition of rolling stock, because it's not a defined term in this statute, that would be other than the buses, coaches, and things that we have that may not be obvious to members of the committee at this time?
Mr. Shetton.
Mr. Chair, Representative, just a little more detail on this particular piece of statute. We were asked to come forward with legislation that would reduce our statutes, the number of pages, whatever we could. And so our transit organization, Metro Transit, came with us with this particular provision that allowed us to reduce language within statute and use put an industry language into law, our standard. Rolling stock, again, covers basically everything that you mentioned, and off the top of my head, I can't think of anything else that it would cover. And again, the idea here was just to reduce the amount of lines within the statute.
Yeah. Representative O'Driscoll?
I'll pass at this time.
Okay. Representative Winkler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shetton, so it's your testimony that the pure reason for making that change is to make the paragraph shorter?
Mr. Shetton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, that was one of the, ideas of bringing forward the unsession bill was to reduce the amount of lines and language in statute. So trying to bring forward an industry standard term into this by reducing that minor piece of language was exactly what we were attempting to do.
Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Shetton, so we're spending staff time and legislative time when doing this. When, if you wanted that impact, I suppose we could have just changed the margins and shrunk the font size. That's what every college student does to hit the page limit. I mean, this seems like sort of a pointless exercise, but I understand it wasn't your idea.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Mr. Shetton,
and Representative Winkler, but we did take this seriously, and it was we were asked to bring forward any types of recommendations to reduce our statutes, whether through repealing language, clarifying language, or just shrinking language, and this falls under that category. And so, yes, this is a very minor change, and it will not change anything if we keep the current language in place. However, with the idea that we were asked to reduce statutory language, this is one of the recommendations that we're making.
I imagine if horse-drawn buggies need to get added to this statute, that would be something the Transportation Policy Committee would also be well-equipped to handle. Representative Driskowski, did you have a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point in that section of the bill, Mr. Shetton, so the effect of this, though, is there's a rather high degree of specificity in lines 3.14 and 3.15 in the current language. And then we strike that and replace that with a much broader term that says any rolling stock. I don't know, where do trolley cars come into this thing, or some other thing that might be an unintended consequence that we are giving this very large unit of government the ability to, the latitude to do things that weren't specifically restricted and directed in statute earlier.
Representative Nelson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Driskowski, what we're deleting is light rail vehicles, and I think trolley cars, as you described them, would fall under the purview of light rail vehicles, and so that's in the current statute. And like I said, this would any rolling stock. And again, one of the things that the governor and this governor's staff has told us going forward, if there's objections to part of the bill, we can remove it. And so if the committee has objections to Section 4, we can easily do a verbal amendment and delete that section, or we can do that in transportation, which is part of what the role that part would reply to is their purview. So, and I'm fully happy to do that if that's what the committee wants to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Driskowski.
Representative Nelson. Should we try Representative Nelson? Mr. Chair, I would move to delete the changes in lines 3.10 through 3.17.
Section 4 of the bill.
Section 4, sorry. Yes.
Is it, just for clarification, do you mean just subdivision 12, part A, so only the rolling stock change, because there are also changes in part B here?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so is that sufficient? Okay. Motion's been made. Any further discussion on this motion?
So, Mr. Chair, just so I get this correct, so when we're deleting lines, we're not deleting from statute, we're deleting from the bill, 3.14. Maybe Ms. Dyson could have the best way to say it.
Perhaps Ms. Dyson could state the motion for our...
Mr. Chair and members, the motion is to reinstate the stricken language on 3.14 to 3.15 and delete the new language on 3.15 to 3.16.
Okay. Is that clear? Representative Kahn, did you have a...
And Mr. Chair, I would support that amendment.
Okay.
Well, the office supports it. I want to. It was a dopey motion.
Okay. Any further discussion?
But I won't tweet that.
All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
The ayes have it. Any further discussion on the bill? Okay. Representative O'Driscoll, you were on the list. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, the concerns that I have had have since been taken care of.
Okay. Any further discussion on the bill? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to speak? Okay, seeing none, Chair Nelson renews his motion that House File 2663 be re-referred to the Transportation Policy Committee. All in favor, please say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it.
Great, thank you. Mr. Chair, we have the minutes to do, and then...
Okay.
I'll make a motion that we approve the minutes from the previous meeting.
March, that's the March 1st meeting.
March 1st.
5th,
meeting.
Excuse me. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the ayes have it.
And members, because we got done with today's agenda, we will not be meeting tonight. And so, see you tomorrow.
Thank you.
Meeting adjourned.
Yeah, tomorrow night as well. That includes, just for so everyone knows, and I'll adjourn the meeting.